You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, we'll talk with a writer to examine the language that we use in conversations around anti-Asian violence and hate.
But we don't need to have people, you know, marching with hoods. We just need the system to be able to function the way that it normally does to benefit white Americans. When we talk about white supremacy, I think we have to be able to name it by the way it's impacting folks. It's a shocking term still, and it's important that it be shocking because we need to be moved out of literally our normal functioning to be able to confront the ways in which inequities are reproduced, are recreated.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. Before we get started, at the Public Press, which is Civic's parent organization, we've been working really hard during this pandemic to pursue angles we're not seeing much coverage of elsewhere, or to take a more systemic look at the issues that are surfacing in the headlines. The San Francisco Public Press is a nonprofit, and we're inspired by the public radio model. That's the idea that people who are able to support the work that we do so everyone can have access to it without paywalls or ads. If you think we're onto something, we'd very much appreciate if you could show your support. You can do that by going to sfpublicpress.org/donate or by helping us get the word out about this show. Subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use or leave us a review. It really does help. So thanks. Reports of attacks against Asian Americans have sparked discussions about racist politics, animus, and attacks that have been part of U.S. history for a long time. Along with exclusionary and segregationist laws, white Americans also perpetuated harmful myths about Asian people, including the notion that they were carriers of disease, which was echoed and amplified by the Trump administration. Jeff Chang, author of several books on politics, culture, the arts, and race, including Who We Be, The Colorization of America, has written extensively about this history. We talked about the legacy of white supremacy and how that's influenced the discussion of recent anti-Asian violence. In the aftermath of a lot of these attacks on Asian Americans, I've seen a lot of conversations come up about tensions between Black and Asian Americans, and then counter-narratives that say actually those tensions aren't as important or even as real as solidarity between those groups. And then activists say that, in fact, interracial tensions between different groups of people of color are a product of white supremacy. You've written about race in America extensively and the history of how we talk and think about race in America. So I wanted to kind of peel apart these layers with you. I think that right now people, especially white people, associate the term white supremacy with extremism, like neo-Nazis and white nationalists. And I think that's actually a very comforting idea to a lot of white folks because it means we can very easily disavow it and especially, you know, dissociate ourselves from it. But I also think it's a bit more subtle and insidious than that. What does it actually mean to say that tensions between two racial groups are a product of white supremacy? What are we talking about when we say that?
I think we have to go back to thinking about what white supremacy is, right? Which is really just this concept, this idea that whites are better than all. And should be able to rule over all. It's something that has justified slavery, colonialism, violence of all kinds, including genocide, over the years. And the way that white supremacy kind of takes shape these days isn't just in terms of people carrying Confederate flags and storming the Capitol, or, you know, sort of white nationalist groups marching in Charlottesville, but it also shows up in the ways in which it's not seen. So if you're a fish, how do you describe water, right? if you're somebody who benefits from white privilege, how do you even begin to unpack what white privilege means? This is the result of systems that have been built up over the centuries and that repeat themselves such that the norm, the status quo, actually is whiteness, is white supremacy, is a system in which whites tend to benefit, tend to receive the lion's share of the resources in all cases. And so in our cities, the way it shows up is the fact that, in fact, our cities are not as white as they used to be. Whites were actually able to leave the cities in large numbers after World War II because of government policies that built highways, that supported the development of the suburbs, that gave banks incentives to be able to offer low interest loans to people moving out onto these highways to move into the suburbs. And that well over 90% of these loans went to white folks. And so whiteness carries over from generation to generation, the ability to be able to accrue wealth during a lifetime, the ability to be able to pass on inheritances to folks, such that the racial wealth gap now is enormous, is at a higher point than it's been in many years. When we look at even the way that banks give out loans these days, that people of color, including Asian Americans, are often receiving loans that are much more risky, that require higher terms, that require larger investments, capital investments. So whiteness, this is just to give you an example, shows up in that way as well. And when we talk about what is happening now, I think, in terms of violence that's happening against Asian Americans, you know, the videos that we've seen coming out of the San Francisco Bay Area, coming out of New York City, often portray people of color as perpetrators of violence against Asian Americans. In fact, what we know is the University of Michigan scholar Melissa Borgia has gone over thousands of reports of anti-Asian incidents over the past year and has found that 90% of the perpetrators are white. So why is it that the videos show these kinds of situations? Well, it's because whites don't live in the cities as much as they used to, you know, back in the 50s, back in the 60s, back in the 70s. That, in fact, racial segregation shows up in terms of cities being now overwhelmingly, especially in California, populated by people of color. So these videos show people who are neighbors to each other, who live in community with each other, in which there are not a lot of white folks who are there because of these conditions that have been set up many, many, many years before. So we have to be able to interrogate, I think, you know, the way that whiteness shows up and doesn't show up.
Yeah. I just want to emphasize that because I also was looking that up and I just think that that is a stunning number. 90% of anti-Asian incidents covered in 2020, the perpetrator or suspect was white. And also added to that, only 5% of the perpetrators in these cases were Black. And that's, of course, only the incidents that ended up being reported on, which allowed the researchers to track them. But that differs just so sharply from the narrative. And I can, on one hand, you know, I can understand that most people don't have the big picture overview. So on an individual level, you know, see an image of a suspect on the news and you might jump to conclusions. But collectively, how did we end up talking about tensions between Black and Asian people and not tensions between white and Asian people or even like white hostility toward Asian people? How did that happen?
I think that the narrative, you know, really dates back to, if we could, well, let's start it this way. If we can kind of find a point at which this narrative really begins to take hold, it's in the early 90s.
Right. This isn't new.
In cities. Yeah, this is not new. So this is in the early 90s in cities like New York and Los Angeles in particular. What you see are incidents happening between Asian Americans and African Americans that then kind of reach sort of a climax of sorts. If you're scripting a narrative, you can kind of reach a more tragic climax than the Los Angeles uprisings in 1992, in which $1 billion in damages were inflicted on Korean American owned primarily, but Asian American owned businesses, in which we saw lots of images of Black and brown looters, that there was a dual narrative that kind of came together, the criminalization of Black and brown people, and the sort of victimization if you will, of Asian Americans, in this case, Korean Americans. And Korean Americans stood in some ways, for the whites who had left the city. And so it was a way for this other narrative about Asian Americans, the model minority myth, right? The notion that Asian Americans come in to this country, that they stay quiet, they keep their nose to the grindstone, they never speak up, that they are, in that way, folks who are assimilating into Americans. They own businesses because of that. They are able to accumulate wealth because of that. And then they inevitably run afoul of minorities who are behaving badly, in this case, again, black and brown folks. So these two narratives come together to create this sort of interracial violence narrative that blacks and Asians don't get along.
And you framed that as this sort of suggestion that black and Asian Americans are natural enemies, which, I mean, to me raises the question, then who benefits from that? Because that ultimately benefits white people, who get to be totally invisible and removed from that conversation. Well, it's just these people fighting with one another. It has nothing to do with us.
Right. And again, you know, this is whiteness as invisibility, right? White flight means that capital and people have left the inner cities. And it's also sort of this sort of moral story, in a way, in which Asian Americans stand in as the hardworking Americans, the proxies again for white people.
How has that myth played into the violence against Asian Americans we're seeing now, if you think it has?
I just think that we read these kinds of pieces as, you know, when we see these videos that are circulated via social media, via, you know, sort of the regular media and that kind of thing, that there's an interesting kind of subtle thing that's kind of going on, right? On the one hand, no sort of mainstream media would be out there declaring this black on Asian violence.
Right.
But what they do is they'll say, well, the perpetrator was Hispanic, or the perpetrator was black. They will name the race of the individual. And when this happens in other cases, they will not name white people who have perpetrated violence against Asian Americans. Mm. So what we've noticed in these articles is that kind of identification going on. And I think, again, you know, this is something in which nobody would be outright saying, you know, this is something that shows black racism against Asian Americans, not during a moment of Black Lives Matter and a sort of racial reckoning. But editors will see it, you know, as normalizing to be making these kinds of editorial choices. So that's one of the ways I think that it shows up. And the other way is in the playing up of the victimization of Asian Americans, right? So the narrative of elders as being targets actually in many ways kind of plays up to the model minority myth.
Huh.
These are folks who have done nothing wrong. They're just walking down the street. They're being quiet, and you know, they are the targets for urban violence. And again, too, this notion of urban violence being coded as something that's specifically black.
Hmm. Yeah, can you say more about that, the elder part of the narrative? Because I mean, I know I've talked about that some of these attacks seemed, or that the attacks seem to have been in large part against seniors. Is that is that misguided?
I don't think it's misguided. I think that older folks in general are targets for crime, or can be targets for crime. That's something that any, you know, sort of criminologist will tell you, right? Mm. If you are kind of looking into the kinds of folks who might appear to be targets for crime. you know, the ability, the story that broke in San Francisco of the Chinese American grandmother who started beating her attacker mm-hmm. until he had to be taken to the hospital. The reason that story kind of became so big was, you know, it was sort of almost like a man bites dog type of story, right? It was just like, this doesn't happen.
Right.
So, you know, everybody's celebrating her as fighting back, as being a badass in many ways. So, you know, I think that the way that these narratives kind of blend together, leave us in a situation that has created, you know, tensions, I think, between communities. A lot of community leaders have been meeting and talking about these kinds of questions, talking about how to be able to really control the narrative, how to demonstrate solidarity. Those are the kinds of things that folks have been working on, I think, over the past couple of months.
I'm speaking with Jeff Chang, a writer who's been working in and around Asian American civil rights and author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. I do want to talk about solidarity some more, but I'd like to zero in a little bit more on the language, especially when now the term white supremacy is being used more often. And I think like mainstream media are becoming more comfortable using the term racism. Mm-hmm. How should activists talk about this? How should media talk about this? How should, you know, lay people talk about this when we use terms like this so that there's clarity about what we actually mean? Because I think that part of this conversation has showed where there might be a little bit of murkiness.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sociologist Eduardo Bonilla Silva has actually created a term that I find really useful. It's racism without racists. So
yeah,
that we can see white supremacy, you know, taking shape, right, in the invisibility of whiteness, right, the sort of ways in which whiteness we have to work at identifying how whiteness is showing up, right? That's an indicator that racism no longer needs, although we just had, you know, we've had a historical period in which there have been a lot of examples of it, but we don't need to have people, you know, marching with hoods or marching and declaring white power. We just need the system to be able to function the way that it normally does, to be able to benefit white Americans. When we talk about white supremacy, I think we have to be able to name it by the way it's impacting folks, right? So looking at the way in which communities of color are underrepresented, say, in particular kinds of jobs with prestige and with pay, the way that our norms of beauty still, you know, conform to standards of whiteness in which lighter skins are more beautiful than darker skins, right? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things are all the ways in which we have to be able to name white supremacy. And the importance of naming white supremacy is so that we can undo it. It's a shocking term still, I think, and it's important that it be shocking because we need to be moved out of literally our normal functioning to be able to confront the ways in which inequities are reproduced, are recreated in all of the things that we do in everyday life.
You have tweeted, actually, that we have real questions to face about anti-Blackness in AAPI communities, privilege, and commitment, and that we should have these conversations without the noise and move from the place of humility before those who have been doing the work to build solidarity against white supremacy. For context, this was about, I think it, this was initially about bots attacking people who are online talking about anti-Asian hate. But to me, as a media person, it raised the question of where the noise isn't and where those conversations should be happening. On one hand, you want important discussions to be publicly visible and accessible so that the public discourse changes. On the other hand, that's, you know, a lot of pressure and a lot of opportunity for distortion. So where should those conversations be happening? It sounds like you also know where they are happening.
Well, you know, the conversations have to kind of take place at a level where we're literally engaging with each other. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that situations in which we're yelling at each other are useful forms of engagement at this particular point. I think that what's happened is that, you know, the difficult kinds of circumstances lead people to kind of increase their volume in terms of the ways in which they want to, you know, address the issues. I don't think that it's useful or that it was useful for certain folks to try to jump in and say the way to address anti-Asian violence is by putting a bounty on people's heads. You know, I thought that that was something that was raising the volume.
You're talking about celebrities coming forward and offering rewards for identifying suspects?
Yes, exactly. You know, these kinds of punitive ways of kind of dealing with what are really intense, visceral, deeply felt kinds of issues don't necessarily lead us to being able to come together. It sort of instead triggers some of our worst impulses. And I think that that's where the conversations break down, right? They turn into shouting matches. I think what's happened is that, you know, there's been a lot of forums, there's been a lot of community meetings, there have been solidarity rallies across the country. There have been folks getting together and working together to build programs, to make art, to be able to work together to, you know, focus on shared types of questions and issues. And I think that that's the way in which we express our day-to-day solidarity and we build community. Those are some of the conversations that I think I see kind of happening in this moment. It's what happened after the uprisings in Los Angeles, and it actually led to a whole different kind of politic amongst young Asian Americans. I was one of those folks at that particular point.
Can you talk a bit more about that? What developed out of that? Can you say more about your experiences there?
Well, I think that, you know, there's many of us who kind of came through the early 1990s, you know, questioning what would be the most effective ways of us to be able to empower ourselves. And I think oftentimes the way that the question was framed was in terms of the lack of power that different communities of color had. And so it led us to focus on solutions that would have empowered our individual communities, and in some cases, in many cases, to disempower other communities. So an example of that, for instance, is thinking about public education here in the Bay Area, where, you know, there's been unequal, inequitable funding, where communities of color have traditionally been excluded, and in which there are a, you know, severe lack of resources going especially to Black and Brown communities and to poor Asian American communities and Pacific Islander communities as well.
And that's one area where the conversation was being had at a very heated moment and a very painful moment when we look at what happened with one of the school board members and her remarks from 2016.
And this conversation has been happening since long before 2016, yeah. Right? This goes back decades. And it has to do with how we think about where public resources are allocated. Does it make sense for some of the best public schools in the city, in San Francisco, for those resources to be going primarily to one ethnic group, right? And I think that there's been a strong debate in the Asian American community about that. You know, or does it make sense for us to try to figure out how to continue to desegregate our schools, an effort which across the country began to unravel in the 1980s and really began to impact especially Black and Brown communities in a really, really deep kind of way after the 1990s. It's a type of situation in which if you're arguing for Asian American empowerment, right? You would say, well, sure, that high school or that sort of magnet school or that charter school. Absolutely. Like the it should be, if it's 100% Asian American, then that's how it ought to be. But there's other folks in the community who said, well, no, we've got to be able to enforce these school desegregation orders. We've got to be able to look at the whole picture, where we fit into the city, into the community, and what kind of role that we need to play. So those kinds of debates are still ongoing. They were very much present and very much the flashpoint, I think, over the last year in terms of thinking about getting rid of merit-based admissions to Lowell High School, one of the most competitive schools in the country, really, public high schools in the country. So I think a large number of us who question whether pushing for Asian American empowerment all the time is best for the entirety of the community. And what is the balance? How do we strike that? How do we think about what role we play within the community, and where we push and where we stand in solidarity with other communities?
I think that there's acknowledgement that there are harmful racial stereotypes and that they exist and that they exist between communities of color. But acknowledging that, shouldn't come at the cost of recognizing a long history of interracial solidarity. And it's that solidarity that activists are actually organizing around now. I'm hoping that maybe you could talk about some of that history that comes to mind for you right now. I mean, I'm thinking of like civil rights movement history, but maybe you have other or more salient examples that you think are relevant now.
I think one of the reasons that we chose to root down here in the Bay Area, I was born and raised in Honolulu, Hawaii, is because of the promise of folks trying to figure out what a multiracial community could look like. And thinking about the historic examples, right, like the rise of the Black Panthers, and the inspiration that the Black Panthers provided to the Chicano community, the Latinx community, to the Native American and Indigenous community, and especially to the Asian American communities out here, right? Those kinds of histories, they're really, really important narratives about our place here, right? About this particular place and what makes it special. The whole idea of the counterculture and people trying to create sort of a new world. All of those things, I feel like, led us to kind of think about like rooting ourselves down here, raising our kids here, that people like were committed, that they were engaged, that we'd be well able to walk out the door like we do now, right, in our home here in South Berkeley, and see folks from all kinds of different backgrounds and classes, and be able to have our block parties and our get-togethers and all of those kinds of things, that we'd be able to kind of figure it out. That's such an important part of what the Bay Area is about to me, right? The cultural movements, the idea of multiculturalism, about writers from different backgrounds that Ishmael Reed, kind of, and a whole bunch of other writers, Jessica Hagedorn and Tozaki Shange, right? All of these folks are able to kind of pull together to be able to write together, to be able to work together. Arts, the kind of arts that have come out of here. All of these different types of things, I think, are so key to who we think we actually are here. And so when we confront these different kinds of issues right now, I think that we do it with a little bit of an eye on those who came before us, about trying to do something that would, in their eyes, I think, kind of, make them proud of who we are. And we do it with an eye towards our kids who are coming up in a multicultural place, in which people grow up with friends of all different kinds of backgrounds. That's sort of how I like to think about the Bay Area, and how I like to think about the future that we can still make together here.
Yeah. Do you have any words of advice or lessons to learn from the past about how to actually do that? Because I mean, you've argued that resegregation is the unexamined condition of our time, and the Bay Area and our schools, which we've talked about, are quite segregated. How do we make steps toward correcting that?
I think that we need to be able to get below the surface of things and to be able to really understand the deep paths and the kinds of things that have led us to this particular point, right? So to understand how segregation in the Bay Area, which, you know, has been so beautifully written about, so accurately and broadly written about by people like Richard Rothstein in The Color of Law, right? How that history is still very present in the geographies that we make today, that the presence of massive inequity here has very, very deep roots, and that we're actually exacerbating very, very long-standing problems. And to be able to really listen to each other, you know, to be able to hear where folks are coming from, you know, where folks are in pain, and to center those who are experiencing the most pain. That's I think the key to trying to resolve this is to look at those kinds of questions and to figure out how we all pull together to kind of make this happen. Another brilliant and fantastic Bay Area writer, Rebecca Solnit, she often reminds us that in times of disasters, people form communities that are really focused on justice, on taking care of those who need it the most. And we've seen that, I think, even now, you know, during times of COVID, in which we've seen some of the best in people. But that coexists with some of the worst, seeing some of the worst in people. And I think that, you know, to the extent that we can kind of model ourselves on the kinds of ways in which we come together and belong to each other, those are the ways in which we figure out solutions that we all can be happy about, be proud about.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you talking with me about this.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
That was writer Jeff Chang. He's the author of several books, including Who We Be, The Colorization of America. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. Civic is produced at KSFP LP 102.5 FM in San Francisco. Our theme music is by John Dillon. Our team includes producer and contributor Mel Baker and assistant producer Liana Wilcox. KSFP is a project of the San Francisco Public Press, a nonprofit investigative newsroom. Find our reporting at sfpublicpress.org. Our staff includes publisher Lila LaHood, executive director Michael Stoll, assistant editor Noah Arroyo, copy chief Kurt Aguilar, photojournalist and reporter Jessica Prado, and reporter Nula Bashari. Civic airs Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. on KSFP 102.5 FM. Thanks for listening.